This is fun! The FU Network.
The Broken Clock Podcast is back, and this week we are talking about the irrationality of racism. This is actually our first requested topic. It came to me via a viewer, and so Mouse, Mary, Justin, and I are going to tackle it. Mouse,
wait, we have viewers?
Well, listeners, viewers. Yes, we do. The podcast is apparently doing quite well, but this listener contacted me and requested this topic because he is Asian and he was profoundly affected by the March 12th rant by Bryan Adams. Up in Canada, we sort of refer to Bryan Adams as Nickelback before Nickelback. yes, Bryan Adams, the singer.
Full disclosure, before this podcast, Leanna had to remind me who Bryan Adams was because I did not remember.
And for those of you who don't remember who Bryan Adams was, remember that Robin Hood movie with Kevin Costner, which was terrible, but we all watched it four times anyway because it was everywhere. Bryan Adams did the everything I do.
No, you have to do it appropriately whiny. Everything you do.
Well, it's when a guy with a gravelly voice attempts to do a soulful falsetto, bad things happen.
Yeah.
Right? Like, okay, we can music snob all we want, but that's who Bryan Adams is. Now, Bryan Adams has been a vegan since like 1989. And we all know how obnoxious vegans can be. I say this as a former vegan. Vegans be obnoxious sometimes. So he went on Instagram, and as a preamble to a bit of his song, Cuts Like a Knife, he said, "Tonight was supposed to be the beginning of a tenancy of gigs at the Royal Albert Hall. But thanks to some fucking bat-eating, wet-market animal-selling, virus-making, greedy bastards, the whole world is now on hold, not to mention the thousands that have suffered or died from this virus. My message to them, other than thanks a fucking lot, is go vegan." And then he went on for a message of support for those who are missing out on their shows. This was widely condemned as racist, which, of course, followed with the ripple of, "I don't see how that racist thing is racist." And then Bryan Adams, I don't know if he was attempting to do damage control or he just wanted to grandstand his ethical veganism again. But his apology, you're seeing the air quotes in my voice, in many minds made it worse because he said, of course, promoting another one of his songs, Into the Fire. Apologies to any and all that took offense to my posting yesterday. No excuse. I just wanted to have a rant about the horrible animal cruelty in these wet markets being the possible source of the virus and promote veganism. I have love for all people and my thoughts are with everyone dealing with this pandemic around the world. Here's the appropriately titled song that would have been performed tonight at the Royal Albert Hall. He's clearly very, very angry at not being able to do these shows, right? Now, I do have to correct him on one bit. This is the thing about racists. They tend to get facts wrong. A wet market is not actually a place where they sell exotic live animals.
Right.
A wet market is just what we would call a farmer's market. It sells perishable goods. The places that sell exotic animals or bush meat are referred to as wildlife markets. And a lot of people get them confused because some wet market vendors who sell pork and chicken and often sell things like chickens live because they're open air markets without refrigeration. But some of them sell other animals, in the back kind of thing. So there is some crossover. There is no widespread love for wildlife markets. Activists in many of the countries where they are still legal are working very hard to get them shut down. And there is no evidence that for certain COVID-19 jumped from animals to humans through consumption of any meat, including a bat. We just don't know yet. It was likely an intermediate animal. intermediate animal. It could have been a bite. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know. I mean, some viruses are spread through animal droplets getting into food, like dung getting into food. There's no proof that any sort of meat consumption had anything to do with the spread of this virus. Now, it may turn out to be true. We just don't know yet. And this is another mark of bigotry, is that people just either cherry pick facts to conform to their worldview, or they cite stuff as certainty that we don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. And I mean, until things went crazy in the US, China was one of the hardest hit countries in terms of this. So this idea that they somehow, I don't understand the greedy virus making greedy bastards bit. Like, what does greed have to do with, like, a lack of sanitation, perhaps, poor food handling, maybe, but what does greed have to do with that? That to me sounds just like leveraging a Chinese stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're in the same boat?
Yeah.
Like, that just seems that this whole thing kind of twigged dark corners of Brian Adams' psyche, and it just all came out. And I mean, a guy like Brian Adams, you know, for people who support the theory of white privilege, you don't get a poster boy for white privilege whiter than Brian Adams, right? Like on Facebook, I called him the more vanilla version of Bruce Springsteen. This is a guy who made his money on the pop charts, but kept calling himself rock and roll. Married somebody very rich and moved to England.
I'm sorry, that's like Nana Mouskouri calling herself a rock and roll singer.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Summer of 69 had that kind of guitar pop or you know, but Brian Adams' music is definitely within the realms of, you know, safe for white people sound, right? Like, I don't know. I feel the same way whenever Billy Joel calls himself a rock and roll artist. Billy Joel writes a great pop tune.
Yes.
And this is one of those things where...
And he's a really, really awesome pianist, but yeah. He's not a rock and roller.
No, the fact that he keeps calling it rock and roll, it's like they're you know, fragile masculinity can't handle the fact that they are pop artists.
I know. It's like, oh, honey, no.
Yeah, it's...
Little Richard was rock and roll. Rest
yeah.
in peace.
Well, even somebody like Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
He can call himself rock and roll. There are legitimate rock acts. I would even say a band like the Foo Fighters could call themselves rock. Mm-hmm. But when you are so safe, your music practically has airbags, you can't call yourself rock and roll, right? But I mean, this is at the core, like... This lack of self-awareness, I find, tends to coincide with, you know, racism. We see it in, you know, going back and by, I'm going to use racism as a sort of catch-all term for any sort of bigotry against ancestry. So we're going to lump like anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in as well, because let's face it, they're shades of the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, when Mel Gibson went on his calling a cop sugar tits and ranting against Jews while he was drunk, that had been he had been attempting to become a more serious actor, mm-hmm, and director instead of just doing action movies. And there seems to be a link between pretension and god-awful, horrible racism. That I, you know what I mean? Like a lot of people think racists are these, you know, hillbilly rednecks with a Confederate flag in their pickup truck. And yeah, that kind of racism exists too. If we look at what went on in, I always confuse it with Charlottesville.
Yeah,
Charlottetown, PEI. I always mix those two up. But what's going on in Charlottesville? There were a lot of rednecks there. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of the polo shirt wearing...
Proud Boys.
Racism. Yeah, elite racism too. I mean, the Proud Boys really picked up on that branding of, you know, dress nicely, keep your hair well cut. It sometimes make your racism seem less bad to other racists. Like we can pass kind of thing. And There's an undeniable.
It's what I call it is the Rockwell Blake painting racists, because they look like they're in a Rockwell Blake painting, and that's the kind of world they imagine, or at least what people understand as a Rockwell Blake painting, because Rockwell Blake made quite a few daring paintings.
Yes.
Against racism and segregation. It's just that those are not the paintings that these people remember.
Yeah, which so many artists are like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, racism, this is a critical thinking podcast, and I've been sort of thinking about where the logic faults in racism actually lie. Because let's face it, racism is illogical. George Orwell wrote a absolutely wonderful essay, and I believe it was 1945, called Anti-Semitism in Britain. And he examined, he believed that the core to understanding racism was not why do other people believe this, but in his case, why does anti-Semitism appeal to me? What is there about it that I feel to be true? And like to think that somebody would go out in public and say, I am a bigot. It's unthinkable today, right? Like the bald honesty inherent in this essay. And of course, the left has just tried to cancel George Orwell because of previous anti-Semitic statements as well, which mm-hmm. I think is illogical in its own way. And Orwell talks about why, because he said at the core of any sort of bigotry, he was referring to anti-Semitism specifically, but he tied it into the larger problem of nationalism. But he said what drives nearly all bigotry, all racialized bigotry, is the assumption in the writer's mind that he himself is immune to it. Since I know that anti-Semitism is irrational, he argues, it follows that I do not share it. And this, to a lot of people, sounds completely logical, but it is utterly false.
Mm-hmm.
And the core, I think, because it is irrational, but unless one understands the core of the irrationality, they continue to fall prey to irrationality. We all do it to an extent, right? There's all things that we're just like not objective about.
There's interestingly enough, time to take a shot. Because mm-hmm. Ayn Rand actually wrote an
there we go.
Skating essay about racism in 1963.
Yes, she did.
I would like to quote a part of it, a very small part of it. So she starts saying that racism is the lowest, most crudely primitive form of collectivism. It is a notion of ascribing moral, social, or political significance to man's genetic lineage. The notion that a man's intellectual and characterological traits are produced and transmitted by his internal body chemistry, which means, in practice, that a man is to be judged not by his own character and actions, but by the characters and actions of a collective of ancestors. Mm-hmm. It claims that the content of a man's mind, not his cognitive apparatus, but its content, is inherited.
Right.
A man's convictions, values, and characters are determined before he is born by physical factors beyond his control. This is the caveman's version of the doctrine of innate ideas, or of inherited knowledge, which has been thoroughly refuted by philosophy and science. Racism is a doctrine of, by, and for brutes. It is a barnyard or stock farm version of collectivism, appropriate to a mentality that differentiates between various breeds of animals, but not between animals and men.
Which she's singling in on the same basic sort of idea that Orwell did.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. Now, the one thing that this sort of glances over, and I think it was because she was trying to make a specific point, not because she wasn't aware of it, but Rand tended to go for the jugular in a way that makes her open to, which is why I love her writings, to be clear. But the one of the inherent illogic of racism is that on the one hand, it's about outward appearances, the skin. Mm-hmm. Essentially. But then there's this element of it that is the blood. And then it's about the mind. They keep trying to find some mental, intellectual, or cognitive sameness among races that just doesn't really exist in a, mm-hmm. To a point that's significant. But, you know, is it the blood that makes you a particular race? Is it your skin that makes you a particular race? How do you define race like, we get into the illogic of racism when we get into the illogic of race, in that it's this thing that everyone is affected by one way or another, everyone perceives. But what the hell is it? Like, it's weird. How do you define race? If somebody's skin is dark, does that make them a particular race? If so, what about people from southern Italy who are very dark skinned? Yes, at one point, people from, say, Sicily were considered not white.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, the weird outlier of Spain being a European country that is not seen as white.
Yes. For the longest time, the elites tended to look at Spain, well, outside of its systemic issues. Spain is a little bit like my home country. It's kind of the Ecuador of Europe.
Oh, geez. Yeah, that's true.
Not at times, not as bad as Italy. Italy does tend to have some organizational issues. Spain does have its fair share of historical interesting things.
Yeah, well, Spain was partially conquered by, it was the Caliphate of Cordoba.
Right.
Was a thing. And perhaps that's why Spain sort of gets othered in European definitions. But it's an interesting point, right? We don't tend to think of anything in Europe as being not white. And yet Spain is certainly an outlier in that regard.
Pretty much. And it's interesting that nowadays what people think of, and even what Spain considers its national characteristic national identity as far as music goes, etc. All of it is what they received from the caliphate, what they call the Moorish invasion.
Yeah.
It's interesting because Roma in other parts of Europe tend to shy away from the name, from the, you know, the terminology gypsy, because it was used
pejoratively.
But in Spain, a large number of gitanos, they call themselves, use the term proudly, especially because now it has kind of become the emblematic symbol of Spain. But of course, that does not mean that gitanos themselves do not suffer from persecution and issues with institutionalized cruelty and, you know, drug abuse issues due to broken families, due to the issues with institutional fuckery over there. But yes, Spain has always been seen as kind of like the lesser, Spain and Italy, alternatively, were the lesser siblings of Europe. Well, Italy managed to get away with kind of rescuing itself from that disdain during the 18th and 19th centuries, when they became kind of the, you know, the force majeure of music. You know,
right.
All of the great Puccini, Rossini, all of the great opera composers basically dominated Europe and the United States at that time.
But see, I joke that you're only white if your culture is associated with bad food. And Italy is the example of how a culture can successfully whiten, but with it, your food gets garbage. Chef Boyardee, man.
Well, actually, here's a funny thing. If you look at, his name was Ettore Boiardi. And when he started the Chef Boyardee things, if you look at the stuff he was selling, that was some high quality stuff when he was alive.
Junk. Yeah.
When he was alive, he had a, you know, quality control, and he made, if you're ever interested, look up the YouTube commercials where he was alive and he was showing people how to make his meals. And then you look at the crap in the can that they sell you now that he's dead.
Here's another example, okay? Taco Bell is the only thing associated with Mexico that can say make a run for the border and not scare white people.
Yeah.
It's true. There's something about whiteness and shitty food. People get furious at me when I make this observation. They are so defensive. But British stew, it's like, no, man. The only way British stew is palatable is if you put in stuff that they imported.
Exactly.
And
the greatest British cuisine comes from other countries.
Well, there's a reason that curries are a staple in British pubs now, people.
I know.
But this is where we get into this other irrational element of racism, where people become incredibly uncomfortable the minute you start talking about the fact that to some extent it affects everyone. It impacts our thinking. We all use heuristics that are racially loaded. And, you know, the problem is that critical theory and the Frankfurt School, which you don't get whiter than the original Frankfurt School, right? Like, holy hell, the fact that our entire discourse on race has been structured by something called the fucking Frankfurt School just shows how absurd the whole thing is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But the Frankfurt School, by virtue of the fact that academia still has a whiteness problem, it was the only group attempting to tackle the issue of race that could get a real foothold. There are other organizations out there trying very desperately to do much better, as they call it, anti-racism methodologies now, but they just couldn't get into academics because they were so othered. They were seen as too foreign, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the Confucius Centers, the Aga Khan stuff, it's just not seen as white enough to be accepted as an authority on racist structures, which to me in itself is a real problem with the whole, not just racism, but the anti-racism methodologies going on. Researching this show, I was actually astounded by how little research there is into whether the dominant anti-racism practices now actually work. And the small amount that there is indicates that they don't. They actually run counter to what does work because they are embedded in political correctness and controlling speech and communication. And the only way various groups have found to actually reduce racism is to involve everybody in the examination and education of why people hold the views they do. And the only way to do that is to have open dialogue where people don't have to fear repercussions for what they say on the grounds of political correctness. That's the only thing they found that's worked. Now, most people listening to this are probably like, this hasn't been my experience with anti-racism. It's been the exact opposite, right? It's been shaming people for the things they say. The Brian Adams thing, let's face it, is a version of this, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to change the way he thinks. The public outcry is not going to make him reconsider his thinking or anybody who agreed with him. It's not going to make them reconsider their thinking at all. It is too entrenched. And if you want, this is a joke, so I'm going to use a generalization, but if you want a white guy to believe he's right, yell at him. Like, I'm serious. There's something about the psyche. The psyche of a person who's isn't aware of the benefits they get by being white and being male and straight and cisgendered and all that stuff. If you want to make them believe that they are right and everybody else is wrong, get mad at them. Have an emotional reaction, because bigotry and stereotyping, what does that tie into, right? The angry ethnic, the angry woman. A white male is still the only person who's allowed to get mad and have it not be just, oh, that you're just hot tempered, you know, you're fiery. It's the only anger that isn't exoticized. And that's a real problem.
Except unless you're a ginger.
Oh no, it's fetishized with gingers. Like, really? That's part of the reason it wasn't hard to convince me that people of other races are stigmatized in that way, because I'm taken less seriously when I get, and people think I'm angry at a lower threshold than other people. It's really interesting that the minute I say something off, you know, often we both do it because of our backgrounds. We say something for entertaining or dramatic effect. And so we, you know,
you mean we throw shade?
Yeah, we throw shade, but you know, we do it in a way that's effective.
Right.
And what happens when you're othered in any way is the minute you're effective, you're angry. Because then you're not effective anymore. Now you've lost control.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the real, to me, problems with the Frankfurt School and their anti-racism methodology is that what comes with it, right? Any of these sort of Marxist inspired, because the Frankfurt School, for people who don't know, is the birthplace of academic cultural Marxism. Mm-hmm. They lost the popular consciousness war, and so they retreated to academia and kept things going. And they've been very effective in that regard. But for all their anti-racism gobbledygook, what's the thing that these people do to shut down conversation very, very rapidly? I feel attacked. You're being very aggressive. You're yelling at me. You know, there's never a valid reason for somebody to be upset unless they're doing it. You know, right. If they're doing it on behalf of some poor minority, then it's okay. But if the poor minority actually gets upset and comes at them and says, wait a second, your hands aren't clean here either, they shut down the conversation. They don't just get fragile. They shut down the conversation.
Yes.
And they end up fighting with each other because, oh, the gay guys and the women and the trans people in this whiter than paper collective, you know, they all gang up on the few white, straight, cisgendered men who dare to keep showing up, right? Nothing in the research that I encountered says that this is an effective way to reduce bigotry. Because we go back to, you want to convince a white man he's right, yell at him. And I want to be clear, I'm making a joke here, but jokes are funny because there's an element of truth in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like when a big problem with anti-racism efforts right now is that they found a scapegoat and they put everything on the white man, right? And to an extent, there's a reason for that. Colonialism was a problem. Now, you know, women didn't have a vote, but that didn't mean women weren't complicit in that too.
Right.
But colonialism was not strictly a white thing. There's a game called Ghosts of Tsushima that's coming out right now that is stirring a bit of tension in Korean communities because of the history of that region and Japanese feudal expansionism. And a lot of people don't realize there has been, we talked about the Caliphate of Cordoba, right?
You're right.
Like that, we call it like the Moorish invasion, call it what you will, but let's face it, that was empire, mm-hmm. right? That was somebody going in and conquering and occupying a place and changing the culture accordingly. That is colonialism. It's not just white people that engaged in the practice.
Right. I mean, in Japan, you had the case of what happened to the Ainu.
Yes. Yeah. It's happened through multiple cultures because of European seafaring. It happened to be more successful than some other places. But I don't know how you feel about this, Mouse. Whenever a theory only stands if you ignore or twist facts, there's something wrong with the theory.
Yeah, it's incomplete. And, you're essentially working on an incomplete model to try and make it fit.
Well, to me, I think it's wrong. It's not just incomplete. It's an indication you're wrong. Orwell touched on this, that the reasons, the popular reasons for anti-Semitism he basically said they fit the facts if you combine them together, but he still thought they were missing an underlying truth because no single theory fit all the facts. And I thought that was a really interesting piece of critical thinking.
Yes.
I think the reason a lot of people worship Orwell despite his faults is he declared his faults at some point in his own writing. And that it hasn't insulated him from the critical theory set, but right. for actual critical thinkers, it's like, all right, he's declared this bias. He knew this was an issue. So I can sort of read around this and see if there's anything left once I remove this particular blind spot.
Right.
Now, you have to do that with any thinker. Every person has blind spots. Every person has heuristics that become bigotry. And I think a big challenge for critical thinkers is, where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line between what's acceptable and what's, no, this just ruins the whole thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a tough one because there is a lot. I mean, most philosophy is racist. You know, Kant and Schopenhauer and Aristotle and like the entire
Heidegger.
History, yeah, the entire history of philosophical thought has issues. It was done predominantly by men, overwhelmingly by white people. And, you know, you get into natural law theory and manifest destiny and all that stuff. I mean, a lot of core philosophical ideas were used to justify things like conquest and slavery. And we still draw on that because all academic writing is based on citation and citation is based on precedent. And so if you have to use sources, you have to be very careful not to let the failings of those sources infect your own thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really difficult.
Yes. Like anyone trying to argue for ethics, he is trying to source Kant.
Well, yeah, and everybody does, right? Because that's accepted as sort of the cornerstone of modern thought. But then,
which says a lot about the problems that modern thought has run into.
Yeah, and yet, again, I know I'm doing a both sides thing, but then you get into the critical theory attempts to solve this problem of polluted citation with lived experience. And well, I think we all agree that we need more non-white thinking in all, you know, accepted great works. It's not all created equal. You know, like I think that some of the stuff coming out of hip hop music is actually more wise and more on track than this critical theory discourse. It's all lived experience and it's all the Frankfurt School stuff. And yet, some people cite Tupac Shakur in their papers, but you can't do a paper entirely citing Tupac Shakur. You could with Shakespeare. Why is that?
Uh-huh.
You know, if we look at sort of the hierarchy of the arts, it's no doubt, you know, we see the pinnacle of language, the pinnacle of theater is Shakespeare. But let's face it, Shakespeare was a white guy stealing stories from other cultures.
And making really good body jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was repurposing, but I mean, Hamlet was from Denmark. Mm-hmm. Macbeth was from Scotland, which was a foreign place back then. Romeo and Juliet was set in Italy. You know, you've got Othello and oh, he's a Moor and all that stuff. He was just, nowadays we would consider that cultural appropriation.
Right.
But cultural appropriation is the lens through which we view all literature, even 1001 Nights, as most people know as the Arabian Nights, took stories from other cultures and bundled it into this idea of them being Arabic stories when a lot of them were Persian.
Right. And that's another thing. I do find that the notion of cultural appropriation is very tied with racist ideology. As someone who comes from Latin America, my perspective on this is that when you talk about cultural appropriation, you're essentially saying that a specific ideological, characterological, philosophical, artistic package belongs exclusively to people of a specific ethnology.
Right.
And no one else may use it. But that also means that they themselves should not and cannot use the packages belonging to what they deem other ethnicities. So essentially, right. It is you're boxing people by their perceived race into like little cubbyholes, or little ideological and cultural prisons.
Well, it's segregation. That was the argument behind the segregation of white and black music in the U.S. up until fairly recently in human history.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole idea of a blue-eyed soul singer or a crossover act was predicated on that. That I think anybody who comes at something through the realm of art has an issue with that. Mm-hmm. You know, the musical Hamilton was all about busting that down.
Yeah.
Hamilton is not a great musical. I said it. It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. The thing it does is it reclaims not only American history, but a lot of Broadway conventions for people of color.
Right.
You know, we were talking about this the other day, that the King George character, he's the scene change character. He's the guy that comes out and does a little performance on the apron while they're changing sets in the background. Mm-hmm. That used to be the only role that was really, you know, open to black Broadway performers. Traditionally, it tended to be a fool character, not terribly important. They go out there, they do a scene stealing number, but you could yank it out of the plot of the musical entirely and it wouldn't make a difference.
Yes.
And, you know, as much as I don't think Hamilton is, you know, as inspired as everybody thinks it does, I think that the conscious structural things that Lin-Manuel Miranda and his 20 co-writers did there, I think that's very important, because, you know, as a student of theater, it really makes you see how racially segregated the arts are. You know, it seems that the higher brow the art, the more racially gatekeeped it becomes. I mean, you've told me a lot about this with opera.
Yes.
And some of the barriers you've come across, which I admit, as somebody who didn't know a ton about the politics of opera, was shocking to me. Because, you know, to me, opera is a bunch of big dudes who are usually foreign speaking in another language. But you made me realize that from the internal structure of opera, no, it's very much the attractive, physically fit white man in every part.
Nowadays, yes, used to be. Well, that came about with the advent of telecasting, which is funny, because that's what they wanted. That's what they used to make opera more accessible.
Yeah.
But then, of course, they started hiring more Broadway and TV-oriented people in their PR departments, who started pushing the notion that, hey, you know, Pavarotti's not really that sexy. When he dies, we can start actually hiring, you know, thin tenors. And here's the thing, you can have thin tenors. The problem is that all that breath does cause thoracic expansion.
Yes. Belly dancing is the same way. You get a rounded upper abdomen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's you use the muscle, it grows. The ridiculousness of various performing arts, that you have to be physically strong but not look physically strong, is absurd to me, but it's very, very real. That's interesting that came through Broadway, because I mean television and radio also facilitated the segregation of white and black music in the US because it was mass broadcast and they hid behind the sensibilities of the audience, mm-hmm. right? And yet the audience has no direct say in what gets played. They consume what they're given. They can't right. go in there and change it. And so that's another thing I find about bigotry. There's a lot of passing the buck. I mean, Orwell talked about that in that it's something other people do. I can't be prey to it because I recognize that it's illogical, you know? And yet you see people who are very learned in other ways hold their purse, say, a little tighter when, say, a black man walks by.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this, like, firsthand. It's not up in Canada. It seems to be other signifiers that cause people to be uncomfortable. How you're dressed, how you carry yourself, how you speak, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., I did notice that it didn't matter how nicely dressed or how clean cut a black man was. You saw that flinching in mixed race company when there was close physical proximity. And I admit, it stunned me. It's not that racism doesn't exist in Canada. It's just maybe it's either it's more buried or it's of a different sort. I mean, I know people right now, part of the reason the Bryan Adams thing hit so hard is there are Chinese Canadians right now afraid to go to the store because of the anti-Chinese racism that's happening.
That has become...
Yeah. And that's real. I mean, that's the thing. This was sort of the comment we made in a previous podcast that the viewer that recommended this topic said that was really great. The idea that race is something that's forced onto a person. It's not something innate. It's something that people are forced to pay attention to. And, you know, that when we talk on the subject of white privilege, that's something that white people or, you know, there's a strata of race. The people who are almost upper echelons of the assumptions other people make, you know, your interactions with the police are going to be different. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be good. It's just mm-hmm. not going to be as bad, right? You know, application into colleges, renting. I had no idea how hard it was for a black person to rent an apartment in parts of America. That was an eye-opener to me. A friend of mine went down there and had a real problem because the city she was in, there's racially enforced housing stuff. And she had to present like her master's degree and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So people didn't think she'd be having loud parties all the time.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener. And, you know, this was in the Baltimore area that I saw as like sort of a black plurality or a large black population. But there's me missing. Yeah, just because there are a lot of black people doesn't mean they're in charge. You know, it doesn't mean they control those decisions. And, you know, getting back to the stuff up here, the fact that Chinese Canadians are actually experiencing bigotry because of this virus. And in Toronto, it's a double whammy, right? Because we had SARS, we got hit really hard by SARS, mm-hmm. which is why COVID didn't hit us as hard.
As hard, because you knew the drill.
Yeah, but this is where we get into the nuance of things. And a friend of mine had somebody say to them, I don't hold you personally responsible, but we have to be honest about the race this virus originated with. Conflating race and nationalism and government structure, right?
And here's the thing. I'm reminded of this. So the American scientist received a letter. I don't remember when it was. When this person wrote in protesting an article about They published an article about called refuting a myth about human origins, and this person said, "How can you say that there are no that a race isn't a reality because different races react differently to medication, and therefore it's an important." And Dr. Shea over there, actually, I just found a quote. Can I quote it?
Yeah,
she said I don't know if Dr. Shea is. So I just say they said an anthropologist who proposed using race as a serious way of describing human variability would be laughed out of the profession, not for reasons of political correctness, but because the idea displays a manifest ignorance of biology. More than 60 years ago, M.F. Ashley Montagu demolished the concept of race in his book Man's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race, 1945. Nevertheless, like many a bad idea, the notion persists that there is some useful purpose in classifying humanity into 5, 6, or 12 races, but it persists at the margin of anthropology among popular science books and the non-scientific imagination. Living humans share too recent a common ancestor for there to be any deep-seated biological differences among us. From an evolutionary standpoint, we're all Africans. Yes, there are geographic differences in human biology and perhaps in vulnerabilities to particular diseases, but seeing these differences as meaningfully organized around a race is a distraction from the search for the actual social, economic, and physiological causes of these diseases.
Yes, that's, you know who, you know, want to hear a funny kind of aside? You know who first introduced me to that theory? Edward who? James Olmos.
Really?
Yeah.
Captain Adama.
Yeah, Captain Adama, stand by me. I was interviewing him at a comic book convention, and he started, I have no idea why he brought this up, but he said race isn't real. And of course, everybody in the audience was like, come on, you know, this was 10 years ago. But, you know, even then the wokeness had started, and Edward James Olmos is Hispanic, right? Mm-hmm. But he started talking about the fact that biologically, like actually genetically, there is not enough distinctiveness by the way we sort it. Like race as we perceive it is a colonial construct. Mm-hmm. It's not actually based on the genetics you get in say one of those DNA tests, right? Which are apparently not as they're not as cut and dried as they make it seem with marketing.
Right.
But when geneticists or biologists deal with quote unquote race, you know, looking at genotype and things like that, the groups they're dealing with are a group, say the Amish, who don't have a lot of intermixing with other groups.
Right.
And, you know, now that we're getting into the whole idea of mixed race people, it's really complicating this idea of those 5 or 6 types of people that everyone has been taught are so meaningful. And the more people you meet from around the world, like I have a couple friends from Sri Lanka, and you know, here we would not see a major difference from a Tamil person and a Sinhalese person. Mm-hmm. But that's a big distinction in Sri Lanka, right? And this is why I keep going back to the idea that racism, even our generally agreed upon concept of race, is illogical. Like the lines we draw, the fact that we treat a West Indian person, a Caribbean person, as essentially the same as a person from Africa or a Polynesian person, you know, and then you get somebody like Dwayne Johnson, who's both, you know, his grandfather was from Samoa, but his dad was a black guy from Nova Scotia. Like, how do you racially sort Dwayne Johnson? He's the Rock. I mean, he sort of represents everything, right? But it makes the point, right? Is he Pacific Islander? Is he black? Well, it really depends on the conversation, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And when something's situational, can we really call it something we can rely on as motivating anything. I mean, he can call on his Samoan Hawaiian ancestry when talking about, you know, conversations between the scientific community with the observatories and then the, you know, Hawaiian holy sites. Mm-hmm. But if it's about race in America, well, then his Black identity becomes more valid. And somebody like this, somebody like Shakira, who's like Lebanese Colombian, I believe. Mm-hmm. How do you sort that? You can't. And it's interesting. Is this so in Ecuador that it's more a nationalistic sorting?
No, that- unfortunately, Ecuador has. As I mentioned this before, there is a contingent of people who prized whiteness. The clearer your skin, the whiter your skin, kind of gives you more prestige, more credibility. If your skin is darker, you're often not seen as that attractive. They have this whole shade of darkness thing.
Interesting.
And of course, it's absolutely ridiculous because the large portion of the Ecuadorian population is mixed. I have Black relatives on my mother's side, Native relatives on my father's side. There's Sephardic Jew. There is Roma, and there's a Scottish mercenary.
Yep.
That's my grand.
Those Scottish missionaries got everywhere, man.
Mercenary.
Oh, really?
No, he was a Scottish mercenary that was brought in by the president of Ecuador. This is my great grandfather. Apparently, not content in putting his little flag in Ecuador, he kind of went across Latin America. My father to this day keeps finding cousins he never knew he had.
Wow. Wow.
Of this man. And then he went to, I believe it was Jamaica. And
right.
I think one of the airports there is named after him.
It's interesting because I have a friend in Mexico. And she's saying that where she is, they don't talk, I'm Lebanese Mexican, I'm Egyptian Mexican, I'm Spanish Mexican. You're just Mexican. Because the hyphenations would be way too long.
Well, in Ecuador, you've got, it's a lot, Ecuadorian people tend to have a lot of cockroaches in their head, as I called it. For example, there is a certain prestige attached if your last name is, for example, Benedetti. Ferretti, all the Italian last names, the more bombastic sounding foreign name you have, and if you're clear skinned, if you're blonde and blue eyed in Ecuador, people go like, oh, kind of stand
really
of you. Yeah, it's really stupid. and of course, there is a province in Ecuador called Esmeraldas, which translates to emeralds.
Yeah,
this province is. Has a disproportionately large number of Black people. Huh. This is because the disproportionately large in comparison to the distribution in the other provinces and the cities. This is because that was a common spot for Black slaves to escape. And in fact, in one of the cases, there was a shipwreck. And the Black slaves knew how to swim, so they saved themselves, whereas all the Spaniards drowned.
Right.
And they made it to the coast. So when you go to Esmeraldas, that is, of course, where the famous Esmeralda Marimba comes from. There's troops of Marimba players there. And it's a very, very much Afro-Caribbean type culture in Ecuador.
Yeah. Really?
But it's very interesting because people go there. It's a very, very famous tourist location. Mm-hmm. You get the impression that it's treated as a curiosity. It's a nice place to visit.
But you wouldn't want to live there.
Or you wouldn't want to marry someone from there.
Okay.
Now I realize that in many ways I am kind of not typical. My family is not typical of Ecuador as far as where their social status, well, as the as as it comes to the type of ideas that people in our social standing, you know, like lower middle class, that's one of the places where you have this fetishization for the, you know, the European, Italian, Spanish last names and mm-hmm. whiteness, etc. Whereas my mother, on the other hand, she completely embraced the black part of her family tree. And she was one of the least prejudiced people I've ever met in my life. There was a woman, Hilda, mm-hmm. Who was from Esmeraldas.
There you go.
She was one of the most beautiful women I've ever met. But not, this is interesting because she has a little parallel with Josephine Baker here, because not really tolerating the racism that was in Ecuador against black people, she left for, she grabbed her bags and fucked off to Paris. Mm-hmm. And there she became an internationally famous model for artists. At one point she became one of Picasso's muses. But then when she came back to Ecuador, it was kind of like a loss of status, because many people still, unless they were in the arts circle, mm-hmm. didn't really treat her very well. Yeah. And she was a very frequent guest in our house. She was a lovely woman, beautiful outside, beautiful inside, very, very warm, incredibly well-read, and like razor sharp wit. But you could tell that when my mother would invite Hilda to some of her gatherings, some people would flinch.
Yeah.
Of course, the funny part is that if they did that two or three times, they would never be invited to my mother's reunion anymore. Yeah. Hilda would, but...
we've found that we invite people to seders, and we have people from... We sometimes have no other Jewish people at our seders. We invite people from all over the place, and you really see a different side of a person if they're not used to like socializing with people mm-hmm. who they perceive to be different.
Yeah.
And this is something that's always been, I admit I've been pleasantly surprised by certain people and very unpleasantly surprised by others recently with mm-hmm. the whole coronavirus thing. It's interesting because I was recently talking to a friend of mine who we all kind of knew he was more than a bit of a racist. Mm-hmm. And then he started seeing this Asian lady and it got quite serious. And she made it clear to him that he was more than a bit of a racist. And I was talking to him about, he actually stood up to somebody else's racism over the Brian Adams thing. And he actually said to me, because he said the thing I didn't say because I didn't want to come across as bitchy. Mm-hmm. And I messaged him. I said, oh my God, somebody had to say it, because it was one of the Brian Adams supporters. And I basically thought, oh, look, one white guy saying what another white guy did wasn't racist. Well, actual Asian people are telling him it was. And I don't think that I feel you're racist, that makes you racist. That's begging the question. That's not good logic. But there were actually reasons being explained to this guy. And I still don't see it. I still don't see it. And so I messaged this guy and I said, like, good, somebody needed to say it. I wasn't going to. I was more sort of reasonable. And then we get into this reasonableness and race and all this stuff. But he actually said, look, I know I'm racist, but I'm trying. And I realized there's really no rewards amongst the elite for people who have that realization. Hmm. You know, he was saying that his girlfriend was making him aware that, no, you don't call Asian people Oriental. He said, I just learned that 2 weeks ago. She said, do I look like a fucking rug? And, you know, this is such a nature versus nurture thing. And it was heartwarming in a way to see this guy getting his ass kicked on the regular by a woman that, despite all his, I really think, learned prejudices, he fell in love with anyway.
Yeah.
And it really shows that the core of a person and what they've been taught to believe aren't necessarily the same thing, you know, and people can be, people can evolve. People can be educated out of prejudice.
You've got to be carefully taught.
There you go. Now, I mean, I want to ask you about this idea, because I looked, like I said, I looked into it, and we'll close on this. There's so much we could have got to here, but I really want to kind of stick to the illogic of it all. This idea that racism, if you have racist ideas, you are just a bad person. And the correct thing to do is call it out or to ostracize the person with the bad ideas. This seems like an absolutely excellent way of perpetuating racism, because it makes people afraid of examining their own thoughts. Because if you don't examine your own thoughts, you can be ignorant to your own racism. If you examine your own thoughts, you have to admit that you have some racist ideas. And racist ideas are different than objecting to structures within certain cultures, such as communism. You know, you can take issue with the fact that even though there are quote-unquote elections at the regional level in China, it's one party. You know, there's no real choice. That is not saying anything about the Chinese people. That is their structure of government. You could say the exact same damn thing about places like Russia, right?
Right.
But if a person actually recognizes that they are uncomfortable around black or brown people, or they have sort of that model minority view of Asians or South Asians, in that they're fine when they're serving them drinks or food, but they can't see them as an equal, there is now active, they're dissuaded from confronting these views, because this must mean you are rotten to the core if you hold these ideas. And, you know, Orwell touched on the fact, well, I'm not an idiot, I'm not a bad person, therefore I can't be this, because we've so equated bigotry with evil. And, you know, I always like to end these podcasts, but what do we do about it? And, you know, unfortunately right now, it is true that I think there's too much emphasis on non-white people making white people comfortable. There's so much evidence of that. But it seems to me that in order to get past this, everybody's going to have to be uncomfortable at various times. Uncomfortable is not the same as being oppressed or marginalized. And unfortunately, thanks to critical theory and thanks to the Frankfurt School, being uncomfortable and being oppressed are now treated as the same thing. You know, some asshole rando saying something awful to you on the internet, uncomfortable, right?
Right.
A cop you have an interaction with judging you negatively based on your race, that's oppression.
Yeah.
As is hiring, as is, you know, there are places that it's more significant than others. And, you know, it seems like the anti-racism people, have you read any of these anti-racism papers or transcripts from a round table?
I have not. I found some that I intend to look at, but
it is astounding to me the way so many words spill out of people's mouths. And if you actually try to analyze the meaning behind those words, how thin it is. It's a lot of jargon related to jargon related to jargon. And if you actually try to summarize what they're saying, the white people are basically saying, I'm listening respectfully. While the people of color on these tables are basically, I'm angry at you and I want to be allowed to be angry at you. And that's where it keeps getting stuck. You know, you start hearing about comfort and responsibility and obligation, and this is all well and good, but it comes down to what I said to my friend when we were talking this week. And I realized some people could be, how could you be friends with someone who is a racist? You know, it's like, look, it ain't just my white friends who are racist in some ways. Like, racism is not exclusively to white people. Trust me. But, you know, I have friends with homophobic views. I have friends with sexist views. You're never going to find a perfect person. And I think the real measure of somebody is whether they're willing to listen when you confront them on things like this. And I said to my friend, it's amazing how when you shift your thinking about the whole thing from good person, bad person, and shift it to, do I want this person to like me and continue to associate with me? How much less defensive you become when you're called out on some of your funny ideas.
Yeah.
You know, and I really think it does come down to that. Like, it is baffling to me the way some people just assign accusations of racism based on nothing but emotional circular logic. By that, I mean, I feel you're racist, therefore you're racist. But then other people, just the minute it's pointed out to them that something they've done may come across in a way that seems quite bigoted, they just shut down. They refuse to hear it. Mm. And I think that has to do with the bad person, good person kind of thing. You know, you're not a good person if you're going around accusing everyone of racism. It's interesting. There was a study of upper middle class white families that a woman did in, I believe it was Australia. And one of the things that she found is because anti-racism among white elites was such lip service to the kids had absorbed it on such an interestingly honest level, the way children tend to, that children were calling the game of chess racist because it was black versus white.
White.
And, you know, assigning human characters to inanimate objects. And what the research determined was that to these kids, anti-racism had become such a cartoon that it was now meaningless. And she was very concerned. She said that, you know, upper middle class white liberals, they want to have this opinion of themselves as anti-racist, but they still are quite fine perpetuating the advantages they have as white people. And that's when we get into this, unfortunately, the critical thinking community and certainly the skeptic community bears some fault for this, because their whole idea of selfishness, and more the Richard Dawkins kind of the selfish gene, that it is totally natural for people to want to give their immediate family every advantage they possibly can have. And I don't think it's fair to ask people to just, oh, let your kids do less well because you have an unfair advantage, right? Nobody's going to do that. Nobody is going to do that. Let's be fair. But let's, you know, I think it's important when these people, because of the inherent advantages they have. And I mean, I tried to do this growing up in a majority black neighborhood and seeing how real racism is. You know, when I got out, and that's what they say, going out and going to the working world, you get out of the neighborhood.
Of the neighborhood.
You know, I was very conscious of, no, don't just assume that white person that you may be most comfortable with is the best person for the job because you get along with them better. assume that somebody who is going to challenge you more because they have a different viewpoint is the right person for the job. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's no shortcut to that kind of self-resilience and self-compassion and creating a true team. And we're so far away from that as business cultures right now. That's a whole other topic. The illogical things that businesses do, how capitalism is no longer capitalism. Mm-hmm. But like all these things people should do. I don't know if you found this. All these things, the stated view a person has of themselves and how they actually behave are so often complete opposites. You know, to me, it's video game websites that are the pinnacle of this. They talk about racism and sexism and homophobia and, you know, transphobia and all this stuff. But if you actually look at who's writing for the site, if you go to the staff page, especially in upper management, mm-hmm. most of their upper management are white, straight, cisgendered men. The plurality of their writers are white, straight, cisgendered men. They have a few women. There are a lot of women of color because, hey, let's face it, then you have two tokens in the same body, right? There's a lot of gay writers, and there are trans people are overrepresented in the games press. But when you actually look at the number of visible like racial minorities, ethnic minorities on video game websites, for all their decrying of racism, you can barely find a one. And I look at that as somebody who, you know, people of, you know, black people and brown people were my friends. They were my classmates. They were my peers. I look at this and I immediately see the problem. Another person who looks just like me looks at it and does this guy who's a patron of mine, he calls it Westworlding. That when they see something that's going to
challenge
the nature of their reality, it doesn't look like anything to me. And to me, this is the biggest bloody problem we have with racism right now. Just, you know, the tiki torches and the Bryan Adamses and Trump's nonsense aside, the real big daily issues with racism that affect the majority of people are of that Westworld type, that somebody looks at something like the Bryan Adams screed that make them question the nature of their reality, and they just blank. They just shut it out. You know what I'm saying?
They blew screen of death and then let's pretend this didn't happen.
Yeah, it's just, I don't think it's racist. It's like, well, that's nice. Why? And this is my challenge. This happened to me when I got called racist over a video game. But I am able to explain why the Bryan Adams thing is racist. Mm-hmm. First of all, it relies on facts, not on evidence. But it also harkens back to this idea of Chinese people in the Yellow Peril. When everybody was like Fu Manchu or some mm-hmm. sort of Genghis Khan type, they were either a bloodthirsty savage, which, let's face it, bat eating evokes that,
yeah,
or some sort of corrupt businessman and or weapons dealer and or both, right? Mm-hmm. Virus spreading greedy, like he just invoked tons of Yellow Peril stereotypes for no need, you know. This great humanitarian who is picked up on a lifestyle that, let's face it, Buddhism made possible. Come on, we wouldn't have veganism if recipes didn't exist, you know? They'd all be anemic and probably vitamin B deficient. Uh-huh. But, you know, he didn't question for a second.
What was coming out of his head?
Well, gee, maybe something like poverty is why so many people in certain parts of the world eat things that we consider gross. Mm-hmm. Maybe a lack of access to proper education is why so many of those superstitions persist. Mm-hmm. You know, it is not the fault of someone who grows up under those superstitions any more than it is the fault of somebody who grows up a redneck in Eastern Kentucky. Question is, what do we do about it? And this, it's amazing how many, if you Google anti-racism, it's amazing how many of these sites do not have clear things that you can do to make yourself less racist. So just be aware. How, like, asking somebody who has racist ideas to be more aware of those racist ideas is asking a blind man to see or a deaf woman to hear.
Yes, it's the reason they're there is because they don't know. It's because people tell right. them you're being racist, and they go, well, am I a racist? Well, and if your answer is, oh, well, you just got to be aware.
Yeah.
It's kind of an indication that they're already working with a broken,
right.
From a broken perspective.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, the only way to cut down on this stuff is diverse environments. Mm-hmm. And diversity is a bad word now, right? But it's true. The only way you really understand another person's perspective is to see them as a peer. And unfortunately, the only way some people are going to be able to see people of different races as peers is being forced into contact with them through work. Mm-hmm. Now, the unfortunate thing about that is, man, I don't want to make, I have this issue with managing. It's good for the racist to have to deal with people who are different from them. But I don't want to make that the responsibility of the other people who are just there to do their jobs.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the thing that personally I think that unchecked bigotry that somebody isn't willing to work on, I think that makes them less desirable as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that if you've got, say, a white-dominated workplace, you don't really realize how racist everybody is until you put somebody in who's on the receiving end of it.
Yeah, that's when you risk the first conflict.
Well, but it's also, I mean, you've got an office full of 10 racists and one target of the racism. Like, that's horrible mm-hmm. for that person, and nobody wants to be that person, and nobody should be that person.
Yeah.
But that's where I come into the thing of everybody's got to be somewhat uncomfortable, in that if we just protect people out of racist environments, that means that in the higher paying professions, people of color never get, and I know some people of color don't like the term people of color, and I don't know, non-white is bad, people of color is bad, I'm aware of this, but I don't know what to use, because everything's bad, but if they're protected out of opportunity, then they never get that opportunity, and the highest echelons of wage earners stay overwhelmingly white. It's an mm-hmm. intractable problem.
That gets perpetuated
if it's the whole thing of, you know, someone being uncomfortable in any way is a bad thing. Learning is uncomfortable. I mean, Betty Friedan talked about that in The Feminine Mystique, that mm-hmm. Learning things is uncomfortable. And I mean, let's face it, there's a line. If somebody is just unrepentantly racist,
mm-hmm.
they gotta go.
Yeah.
Right? But people shouldn't be so afraid to say something that might be wrong that they just keep thinking it and never have it challenged. Which is why I found that moment my friend talked about where his girlfriend was like, do I look like a fucking rug to you? The fact that he got to almost 40 years old and no one had ever pointed that out to him, you know, just shows he needs more exposure. Bless the guy. He took it. He knew he was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, those are the, and that's because she had the status. she had the license, she had the agency to speak up about that stuff. And the other anecdote I had this week that is so relevant to this podcast that is the opposite thing, because I focused a lot on white racism, but there's a lot of propaganda coming out of the Communist Party of China about coronavirus too, right?
Of course.
That it actually came from Americans, which, let's face it, is its own racism and xenophobia at its root too, mm-hmm. right? That's no different than saying it came from the Chinese.
Yeah.
The truth is that the coronavirus outbreak in North America came from Europe. It didn't come directly from China. And part of the reason it got so bad in province of Quebec here and the U.S. is because of you know, people in Quebec went to France. In the New York area, it was travel between places like Italy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't China. And the emphasis on it being a quote-unquote Chinese virus blinded, you know, a lot of North America, more so than Canada. They kind of knew it was coming, but couldn't stop people because it hadn't gotten bad enough to do anything yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, it blinded some policymakers to the fact that Europe was a super spreader area. And that's the problem with racism. So a friend of mine who is Asian, his parents are, I believe, from Hong Kong, said he had a fight with his parents this week when they were buying, you know, hook, line, and sinker, Chinese Communist Party propaganda on coronavirus. And he apparently said to them, like, look, my whole life, you told me to get an education, to think critically. And mm-hmm. now you don't like that I'm challenging you on, you know, being set in your ways and just buying anything the government of China puts out. If you don't like what I'm saying to you right now, you brought this on yourself. And I mean, this is why I love this particular friend, right? Like that is the mark of someone who not only can stand up for something that he feels is wrong, but also he can express himself rationally enough to create basically an inarguable defense of his position.
Yeah.
You know,
that's pretty badass.
And had some pretty great style points to boot. So, you know, Mouse, you're more affected by this than I am in this particular thing. What can people do to close, to be more logical about whatever sort of racial biases or you know, just weird things they think about other people in the depths of their mind that are afraid to encounter? How can people start challenging themselves in their own heads?
Well, it's a multi-step process. The most important thing that you have to remember is that bad thoughts don't make you a bad person. Bad actions make you a bad person. Especially when you suspect that what you might be doing is wrong, but you double down anyways. You need to make sure, first of all, you need to make sure to remember that as far as the human race goes, fundamentally, we really aren't very different. Mm-hmm. We aren't, and in that sense, I mean racially different. As individuals, we are all different. You're going to find, just look at America. You're going to find the worst of trumpensies. You're going to find conspiracy theorists. You're going to find logical people, rational people, kind mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. So just from that point along, are you going to try and create a racial identity out of that? Because you can't. You really can't.
No.
And then, you know, you try and do that in every country. And here's the thing. The only reason why most racists can't build a consistent racial profile out of their populations is because they know them too well. You can't. You'll notice that most, for example, white supremacists, very, very Seldon can make the case, you know, we're all racist and we're all collectivists, because then you have to deal with the existence of the white people who are not
right.
from that camp.
Right.
But it's a lot easier to create a racial identity out of countries and societies out of which you know very little except the most basic surface knowledge. All Asians are good at math.
Right.
And that's, of course, a stereotype that came from the modernization of Japan and China.
Right.
When they became, you know, they became very dominant in the technological sector, when they were trade, etc. But, you know, if you actually study, you know, the history of Japan, the culture of Japan, you'll see that that's not all that there is. And in fact, you know, they'll be surprised. Actually, there are Asian people who are as bad at math as I am.
I know a few artists, professional artists, who are Asian, and they can't even do billing. They can't even bill. It's so absurd.
I feel so attacked right now. Racism is a type of collectivism that rests upon overgeneralization. Mm-hmm. Overgeneralization exists due to a lack of verifiable facts. And they exist with shorthand, quote unquote, facts.
Yeah.
And so the greatest enemy of any type of racism is actual, profound knowledge. I'm not talking about, you know, doing research by going to YouTube.
Right. Oh, God.
And listening to Stefan Molyneux.
Yeah.
Who is, here's the thing, Stefan Molyneux, he is a racist, but he's also a very, very, I will say he's a deceptively evil person who's pouncing on this.
He's actively deceptive, where I think Jordan Peterson self-deceives. Mm-hmm. Stefan Molyneux knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't go to YouTube. Do actual reading, such as, for example, just the book that Dr. Shea mentioned. And I'm going to repeat the name here because I think it really should be a book that everybody should read. And remember, this was published in 1945 or 46. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, 1945, just on the trail of one of the most atrocious racial genocides, yeah. racist genocides in history. It is called Man's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race, mm-hmm. by M.F. Ashley Montagu. And that is Montagu. Because knowledge is the banishment of superstition. And to be honest, I consider racism to be nothing more than a secular superstition.
I think you're absolutely right on that point. I think, you know, the George Orwell essay, Antisemitism in Britain, is a good one too. Black Looks by Bell Hooks. Mm-hmm. is another. It was the book that sort of launched intersectionalism that's been disastrously misconstrued now, but Black Looks, Race and Representation is another really eye-opening one, just because it for people who aren't Black, it's an inside look at Black spaces and why certain things are the way they are. Mm-hmm. This is the show Blackish is so good again for this. So if you guys don't want to read and you just want to watch a show, the show Blackish is really good. The Barbershop movies are also really, really, I'm happy that we're at a place now where there's enough of an American Black middle class to have media for Black people. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that will start expanding to Asian people and South Asian people. And I mean, South Asian people are getting into politics up here in Canada in meaningful numbers. But I mean, we have Kim's Convenience up here. You guys don't have that in wide distribution down in the US. Kim's Convenience is a brilliant show. You know, I'd like to see shows for Chicano term is coming back now because people don't like Latinx. But I'd like to see, you know, Latin people have media about them. Robert Rodriguez does some interesting stuff in that regard. But the neat thing about media created by a group for their own consumption and for people of that group is it's much more nuanced than the beat you over the head, let's all be good to each other stuff we get in traditionally white media. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, like the racist cap, the racism episodes in your animated shows in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I had friends who are Russian in high school, and one New Year's Eve, we all went over and they were watching Russian comedies, and they had to explain every comedic trope from the Soviet Union that they were laughing hysterically at. Apparently the buildings are built so similarly that people get drunk, end up in the wrong building, end up getting into an apartment, like into a hallway, and they're completely, because everything's the same.
Yep.
Except for the location. And I needed this explained, and it's like, wow, I just learned something really profound about another culture just through laughter, like through people willing to make jokes about themselves. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, they were all out of the Soviet Union at that point, so they could laugh at it. They had individualism. The arts is so important in that regard. And that's why I feel so strongly that you can't gatekeep what's good art and what's bad art. Art is just art, and it's just whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I guess we'll wrap there. That's a good place to start. Stop. I mean, though this conversation is just shut up, computer. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network. Support us on Patreon, patreon.com/funetwork.tv, or you can find all our content at FU at a store, funetwork.tv. You can go to the store where we will be getting some new merchandise up fairly soon, I understand. store.funetwork.tv. So I am Leanna Kersner. This has been Mouse Mary Jess. Remember that thinking is good for you, even when it hurts sometimes. Mouse, as usual, you get the last word.
And don't be afraid of knowledge. Everything new that you discover is a whole new world.
Song cue.
A whole new world.
This is fun! The FU Network!